Welcome to the weekly roundup of NPR's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulaby. You can subscribe to NPR's arts channel at npr.org/culturetopia. This week, author Jonathan Franzen discusses his latest novel, Freedom. Another author, Edwidge Danicat, has a new book about a boy buried by the earthquake in Haiti and isn't rescued for 8 days. And the provocative third album by the glam rock band Scissor Sisters. It's called Nightwork, and it's the band's first album in 4 years. But first,
the German filmmaker Fatih Akın is one of the stars of European cinema. His gritty dramas about Turkish immigrants in Germany have earned him international accolades, including an Oscar nomination. So it's an understatement to say that his latest film, Soul Kitchen, is a departure for Akın. It's a comedy built around music. NPR's Bilal Qureshi reports.
From the very first beats in Soul Kitchen, you know you're not in for an evening of art house European fare. Yeah. The film opens as Chef Zenos throws frozen fish and chips in the deep fryer, jamming to Quincy Jones in his dingy kitchen, a grungy, very hungry crowd waiting outside. The camera zooms out to reveal the inside of a warehouse in the industrial quarter of Hamburg. The film is a love song to director Fatih Akın's hometown and a restaurant called the Taverna, where he spent much of his 20s.
It was more than just a restaurant. It was like a home base for the whole neighborhood. So artists were hanging around there, but like artists who never really created something, you know?
That restaurant belonged to Akın's best friend, the Greek-German actor Adam Boustoukas, who stars in Soul Kitchen as Zenos.
He was putting like one turntable in it and then a second one, and he asked people to DJ there. I was DJing there. I was there like every day.
That nightly routine inspired Akın to work on a story about the imaginary homes we create as young people. Homes that are less about geography and more about friends, strong drinks, and of course, the right mix of music.
A really good DJ, you see, he's able to mix tracks and you don't realize it as the audience. He's really surfing on the beat. And I was wondering if this is possible with a picture, you know. If you can, like, I don't know, create mixes.
And for Akın, that meant creating a film that echoed what he would hear when he would go out in Hamburg in the 90s. Clubs filled with American black music from 2 or 3 decades earlier. Telling the world.
Sisters and my brother. We came from an American-occupied country, what Germany was. So we were very influenced by America.
And for Akın's crowd, the children of immigrants and interracial relationships, soul music always carried an additional layer of meaning.
When Dyke and the Blazers sing, we got more soul, you know. When we talk, we got more soul. We felt like they speak about us. They speak about people with backgrounds. We have more soul than the white Germans have, you see. That was this identification. We got more soul.
Fatih Akın spent more than 2 years collecting the music for Soul Kitchen and almost $300,000 buying the rights. He then wrote the script based on those songs.
What I do is like I put the vinyl out, I listen to the track, and I read the scene what I've written. And if it makes sense, I keep it.
The result is almost 60 songs on screen and a 2-disc soundtrack which includes tracks by Curtis Mayfield and Donny Hathaway, but also Greek pop songs and German hip-hop, electronic music.
It's basically an extension of personality.
Garth Trinidad is talking about mixing music. He's a DJ and a radio host in Los Angeles, and he says spinning records can also tell a story.
What is it that makes you an individual? And I think that all of us have our own journeys, and we pull from those journeys from the past or from, you know, 5 minutes ago. There's always the individual aspect of what's going on in somebody's life that serves that purpose.
Fatih Akın catapulted to international stardom in 2004 with his film Head On, about two German Turks falling and failing in love. Like the characters in that film, Akın grew up in a Turkish family in Hamburg, negotiating his place as the son of devoutly Muslim parents and as a young German who loved the nightlife. Fatih Akın's films, like his previous drama The Edge of Heaven, pulsate with an intensity and an urgency that comes out of those questions about how we define love, identity, and home in a globalized world. But he says he felt critics became obsessed with asking what additional light he could shed on Europe's immigrant problems. And so for him, Soul Kitchen was an act of defiance.
It really was liberation, in a way. To not be the slave of a certain success, to not be the slave of expectations people have.
Some have called Soul Kitchen frothy, Fateh Akun light, but he says that's exactly the point, to remain true to all of his creative impulses.
Soul Kitchen will always have this very important, it might not be important like, yeah, like saving the world or stuff, you know, but for me it was in so many terms important.
Important because it's a tribute to that now gentrifying corner of Hamburg that set the course for all that's followed in Fateh Akun's films. Bilal Qureshi, NPR News.
And you can see clips from Soul Kitchen at our website, npr.org.
It has been 9 months since a massive earthquake struck Haiti and killed more than 230,000 people. Renowned Haitian-born author Edwige Dantica lost loved ones in that devastating quake, and she's written a new children's book that tells the story of a 7-year-old boy named Junior who was buried in the rubble of his home and found alive days later. Edwige Dantica, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
First of all, I wonder about Junior's story. Is that a real story?
It's derived from many real stories. In my own family, we lost a little boy, a 10-year-old, who had siblings who were also in the rubble. And I remember when the earthquake first happened, my 5-year-old, my husband's mother, was in Haiti at the time, and she kept asking us about her, and she eventually blurted out a question like, is grandma under her house?
So did you begin writing it with the idea of trying to explain this ordeal to your 5-year-old?
Absolutely, because she had a lot of questions, and we were so wrapped up and so worried about family members that we weren't filtering as much. And she had some very direct questions as children tend to. And so I wrote this story to try indeed to explain to her what had happened, but also to find a kind of hopeful moment in it so that it wasn't, at least to a little child, all devastation.
You begin the book with Junior's rescue, which is 8 days after the earthquake. So when we open the book, we know right away that Junior is alive. But then he describes what he did during those 8 days. And I wonder if you could just begin by reading Junior's account of the first day.
On the first day, I flew my kite, and my best friend Oscar, who was with me when my house fell, flew his kite too. It was a windy day, and our kites went high up into the sky. Later, Oscar and I started a game of marbles. We invited all the kids in the neighborhood to play with us. It was the biggest game of marbles ever played in our neighborhood, in the entire country. In the entire world.
And obviously, he's imagining that.
Yes, he imagines that day and all the days that follow. But also there are echoes from his life, you know, moments from his past, also moments with his sister and his mother and father and his friend Oscar. So it's a mix of imagination, but also memory. Because one of the things that I kept wondering about the children, what kept them still, because I have 2 small children, and they don't stay very still very long. And I'd even asked my pediatrician, and she said, you know, the children don't panic as much. And I was wondering what resources they would pull on, and that's how I came to this use of imagination for Junior.
I still would think that even though we know that he survived and that he had these kind of coping mechanisms of sort of recreating memories as he tried to get through each day, I would still think this story would be very frightening for children. Why did you think that this was a story that you could tell kids? Who is the story really intended for?
Well, it's intended for kids, maybe not very young kids. I've read it to my daughter in the early version and completed version, And I've read it to some children in Haiti. And what I've seen when I've read it to different children is that a conversation begins and we start talking openly about sad things, not always an earthquake, but other things that sadden children. But it's also a hopeful story because all children play, all children dream, and that's what is at the core of the story.
I want to mention the illustrations of this book. It's beautifully illustrated with very bright, colorful paintings by a man named Alix Delinois. It's a kind of joyful counterpart to the reality of this little boy. It's the vision, his imagination, the thing that is keeping him safe, I guess. You say in an essay in the end of the book that the Haiti in these pictures is gone now.
It's not completely gone. A lot of it is gone because this child lived in a city, and the city that is partially destroyed, but is also imagining the Haiti outside of Port-au-Prince, the countryside where this child spent summers, where I spent summers. And I think what Alix, the illustrator, does really brilliantly in this, it captures in a way that echoes a lot of beautiful Haitian paintings, all the colors of the landscapes outside of Port-au-Prince as well. When you live outside of the place where you were born, there is a tendency to idealize it. But what's great about memory, what's great about art is that we can reinterpret and recreate and hopefully dream a better world.
Edwige Dantica, her new book is called 8 Days, A Story of Haiti. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
From the 1940s through the mid-60s, Nat King Cole was one of the most beloved and familiar American singers.
L is for the way you look at me.
But here is a side of Nat King Cole that might not sound quite so familiar.
Say, que todo lo que me dirás.
Nat King Cole toured in Latin America and recorded 3 albums in Spanish. Now, some Spanish-speaking musicians have created a tribute album in Espanol.
Sé que todo lo que me dirás ha de darme la felicidad.
That's Cuban singer Isaac Delgado from the album L-O-V-E, the collection of Cole's Spanish hits performed by Delgado. The album also features a couple of duets with Nat King Cole's brother, Freddie Cole. Isaac Delgado joined us from member station WLRN in Miami. He's there along with the album's producer, Nat Chediak, who's also translating for us. And Freddie Cole is at Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Thank you very much, all of you, for being here.
Pleasure being here.
Muchas gracias.
Isaac, let me start with you. You grew up in Cuba. How did you discover Nat King Cole?
Nat King Cole, para mí es algo...
He says that Nat King Cole is a myth, an icon for his generation, and that he listened to him at home. His father actually had a physical resemblance to Cole, and that his mother loved to play his music around the house. When Cole came to Cuba, he seduced everyone. He had the uncanny ability to make you feel that he was singing right to your ear, that he was singing especially for you.
Y a veces escucho un eco divino que envuelto en la brisa parece decir.
Let's turn to Freddie Cole. Freddie, do you know why your brother was so interested in Latin music, Latin America?
Well, his personal manager at the time was a Spanish person, Carlos Gastel. And, they started to talk about this project, and they put it together, and it became one of the best sellers that Nat had in his whole career.
Siempre hasta morir.
Nat Chediak, you produced this tribute recording. How did the idea come about?
I was actually working with Isaac on another project, and he said, I want to do Cole Español.
Did you know what he was talking about?
Instantly. You know, there's no self-respecting Latin who comes from the world of music, who does not know Nat King Cole? I mean, it's just unheard of.
Let's just take a sampling here and try two versions of the Latin standard Perfidia. We'll hear first Nat King Cole, and then we'll hear Isaac Delgado.
Mujer, si puedes tú con Dios hablar, pregúntale si yo alguna vez te he dejado de adorar. Y al mar, espejo de mi corazón, las veces que me ha visto llorar, la perfidia de tu amor.
Isaac, the differences are really interesting. I mean, you have a beautiful voice. You're obviously not imitating Nat King Cole. And there's a little bit of, I don't know, you seem to sort of ease into the rhythm of it in a different way.
Sí, es que we didn't want to make a carbon copy of what had already been done before. So we wanted to be respectful, but at the same time, do it in our own way.
This album includes two duets with Isaac and Freddie Cole. We're just going to listen for a second to Green Eyes.
But will they ever want me? Green eyes make my dreams come true. Aquellos ojos verdes de mirada serena.
So there you have Freddie singing in English and Isaac singing in Spanish. Freddie, did you ever sing with your brother?
No, I played piano on some of his records. I was on the My Fair Lady CD.
I've grown accustomed to her face.
One of our mindsets.
That's Nat Chediak.
One of the mindsets in putting together the repertory was we went beyond the three Latino albums and we reached out to standards, Cole standards, that he never did in Spanish because we wanted to extend it to the entire Cole songbook.
A su mirar me acostumbré. Con ella el sol volvió a nacer.
That's I've Grown Accustomed to Your Face in Spanish, Isaac Delgado singing it. Isaac, I have to say that if I didn't know that song, I would think it sounds perfect in Spanish.
Bueno, estoy feliz de...
Very happy that people respond to it because when they know the song in English, they don't have a reference for it in Spanish. And for people to accept it is very gratifying for them.
Freddie, if I were to ask you to pick a song in particular that brings back memories of your brother, would it be that one?
Oh, I love this particular song, but I have so many memories of my brother, it would take all day, your whole time for the show. Because he was such a great musician and he had such an awareness of everything around him, and he knew how to color here and do this and do that. So it really would be unfair for me to just jump up and try to pick one thing.
Freddie Cole, Isaac Delgado, and Nat Chediak, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Muchas gracias.
Their album is a tribute to Nat King Cole in Spanish. It's called L-O-V-E.
Jonathan Franzen's novel, The Corrections, hit bookstores in early September 2001. A few days later, life in America was no longer the thing he'd captured so vividly in that book. His new novel, called Freedom, takes place against the backdrop of the decade just past. It's already being hailed as a masterpiece of modern post-9/11 fiction. And it took Jonathan Franzen 9 years to write.
I need significant chunks of time to pass before I seem to be able to get a novel going because I need to have something change in me. And, you know, the Owl of Minerva flies at dusk. We see things better later in an administration. We see things later in an era. In some respects, it was good fortune for me that I wasn't trying to wrestle with 9/11 as it was being so over-wrestled with in the media. The book was really written in 2009. It was written after Obama had been elected president, and we could see the decade in some pretty clear perspective.
Freedom tells the story of the Berglund family who live in a gentrifying neighborhood in St. Paul, and in particular the story of the parents, Walter and Patty. At first, their life seems ideal, but over time, the relationship between them becomes more complicated as the children grow up and as Walter's old college roommate Richard Katz re-enters their life.
Walter is a portrait in the displacement of unspeakable rage about what's going on in his family, whose speakable rage about what's going on in his country. And, you know, this was in many ways a book about the first decade of the new millennium and what was unmistakable everywhere, incredibly striking, was how angry everybody was and over the top angry. And Walter is, who was once, you know, a mild-mannered 3M employee, becomes this over-the-top angry person. That's part of the arc of his character in the book.
Much of the early part of the novel is actually written by Patty, about Patty in the third person, and it's actually a form of therapy for her. It's in parts an account of the breakdown of her marriage to Walter Berglund, this incredibly earnest, devoted husband. Why did you want Patty to tell us her story? I mean, were you worried that we might blame her otherwise?
Patty, like a lot of somewhat depressive people sitting on a lot of dark stuff, a lot of dark childhood stuff, a lot of anger, doesn't behave very well. And so it seemed important to try to get her right up front and particularly to tell a little bit about her childhood so that one might have some sympathy for why she was so angry and why she was so lost.
How do you begin to write in a woman's voice? Is that one of the most challenging things that you do as a novelist?
No, actually, it's not. You know, I had a very fraught, in some ways, close and over-identified, in other ways, very estranged and prickly relationship with my own mom. But she was a very dominant personality. My father was a pretty strong personality, too. But my mother spent more time with me because my dad was on the road a lot. And I feel like I got daily instruction for 18 years in how women think and what their needs are. And I was primed, therefore, to really try to downplay my own maleness and be extra particularly attentive to the way women, first my mother, later my wife, were responding to me and responding to the world. So it came to be second nature, and maybe not in such a good way. It led to it being strangely difficult to write about myself as a man in a direct way. I think that's another reason the book is sort of in it halfway in her voice. I wanted to try to get it out of my own hands a little bit and leave some room for the narrator to identify with the three main male characters.
So much of Patty Berglund's story is about disappointment and about expectations, unfulfilled expectations. I think the core of this book is about relationships and about the family dynamics, the Berglund family dynamics. You are yourself are single. You live with your girlfriend, I should say. You don't have any kids. You never have. How do you dive so deeply into family dynamics, parent-to-child dynamics, without having been a parent? Because you've captured it so vividly.
Well, I was a son, and I was a son, what's more, whose brothers had gone off to college when I was still really quite little. And I already talked about the ways in which I perhaps over-identified with my mother. I also over-identified with my father, and they were in their own way each so unsatisfied, so angry about so many things that it was impossible really for a sensitive kid not to internalize their view of the world. And it resulted in my being this strangely middle-aged, you know, 14 and 15-year-old. And it certainly helps to know to have a lot of friends and have brothers who have had children who've grown up before my eyes from infancy to college and beyond. I guess it's what a novelist does, right? You take a small amount of information and you take a small number of subjects and you examine them very carefully. And then you sit in a very, very dark, quiet place, either literally or figuratively, and imagine what it might be like not to be you, but to be somebody else.
You actually, I've read that you've actually neutered a laptop to make sure that you have no ability to connect to the internet.
Yes, yes. No, that's you can just, you take any Ethernet plug and you stick it in the little socket and then you super glue it in and take a coping saw and cut off the wire part. And it is permanently disabled for that form of transmission. And then the wireless card's easy to take out. We're gonna take your mama out all night. Yeah, we'll show her what it's all about. We'll get her jacked up on some cheap champagne. We'll let the good times all roll out. That's Scissor Sisters' hit song from the 2004, Take Your Mama. The band sliced their way into the UK music charts with the biggest selling album of the year. Not bad for a debut. They've since gone on to sell more than 7 million albums, won numerous music awards, collected an array of fans around the world, and been called one of the most enjoyable pop groups in recent memory by Time magazine. It's been 4 years since the band's last album. They're back, dazzling as ever, with Nightwork. Jake Shears and Baby Daddy of the Scissor Sisters join us from the Village Studios in Los Angeles. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
How are you guys sisters?
We go way back, don't we? We do. We've known each other for a long time. Baby Daddy and I met when we were both still in college through a mutual friend, and then we ended up in New York at the same time. So we were friends for years before we started making music together.
Jake was a go-go dancer in New York, and I started helping him make background music for his go-go routines.
I got kind of bored. I mean, I really enjoyed dancing in clubs, like, you know, in my underwear. It was really fun, and I had a good time, but I think I had this realization that I could do a little bit more with that.
And then when we started performing together on stage, we became Scissor Sisters.
The cover is arresting while we're talking about underwear. It's in black and white photo of a man's well-proportioned derriere.
It's a Robert Mapplethorpe photograph, and it's a ballet dancer named Peter Reed. I knew it was the cover for this album. It just summed everything up about this album. It's just a really playful, sexy, hot cover.
Maybe you could say that the album cover is a good metaphor for us as a band. I think on the surface it may be fun, it may be even frivolous at times, and not look like there's maybe much under the surface to some people, but what this photo I think represents, especially to Jake, is a lost time, a time that was lost to AIDS, that time that was lost to people taking real risks in nightlife.
It's a shout out to that whole, you know, there's a whole generation that died, and a lot of creative people passed away, a lot of people that were in their prime.
Robert Mapplethorpe included, we should say.
It being one of them, and that's why it was really,
and Peter Reed himself.
Peter Reed, who's the model in the photo.
Let's listen to your song, Invisible Light. At the doors of Babylon, you are my Zion. Pacing tiger, a keeper's cage. Invisible light shoots from your eyes. A sign. Sailors climb the walls. I thought I saw you laughing 10 feet in the air. It doesn't matter if they touch you, where they cut you, can you give me invisible light? What's the invisible light?
The invisible light is that moment of euphoria on a dance floor when just the music is perfect and you're feeling good and you're in an amazing club with a great sound system, and you know, when all those elements are lined up, you can really get lost in yourself, and it's just one of the best feelings in the world. And I always find a lot of inspiration from that. I can take a snapshot of that moment and pull songs out of it. That may sound crazy. Does that sound bananas?
A little bit. No, I think it's funny. I think it's hard. It's harder for maybe American culture to grasp, because we didn't discover it until we went overseas. It's like a tribal ritual over there to get together
it
and dance
be,
all night.
I mean, we should explain for your millions of fans in the United States, although Scissor Sisters is popular all over the world, you have essentially been adopted in the UK.
when we were starting out, there weren't any American record labels that wanted to sign us. So we, you know, it was a British record label, Polydor, that signed us initially. So it's kind of, that's where our sort of musical base is.
Which brings in a guest appearance you have on this CD. Toward the end of Invisible Light, you hear this familiar voice.
Whose laser gaze penetrates this sparkling theater of excess and strobed delights? Painted whores, sexual gladiators, fiercely old party children, all wake from their slumber to debut the Bacchanal. Come to the light, into the light.
That's Sir Ian McKellen.
Yes.
How did you get Sir Ian McKellen to do this?
We just called him up. And he's a fan, you know. He's come to our shows, and he's, you know, we've met him many times, and
he was performing Waiting for Godot with Patrick Stewart in the West End, and we showed up at the theater with the digital recording equipment and recorded him right there.
It was amazing. I'll never forget it. It was hard not to burst into laughter because it sounds like God.
Well, we did think about the voice of God, and his name was the first one that came up.
You mentioned that you met when you were in college, right?
We were really a band born out of September 11th.
I have heard this story that in fact your first performance was it even just 10 days after September?
10 days later, it was September 21st. It was such a strange time, and we had been, you know, we had just been playing around in the studio and making these funny little songs, and I just remember sitting there saying to Scott, Baby Daddy here, I was just like, why don't we find a place to perform one of these?
The feeling that night, it was almost very urgent. It felt like there was a reason for everyone to be there, entertaining each other.
And the nightlife at that moment was really wild. People were just happy to be with each other, and it was an amazing moment.
Let's listen, if we could, to your song, Fire with Fire.
You can see that you're being surrounded from every direction. Love was just something you found to add to your collection. It used to seem we were number one, but now it sounds so far away. I had a dream we were running from some blazing arrows yesterday. You said fire, fire, with fire, fire, with fire, fire, with fire.
We're speaking with Jake Shears and Baby Daddy of Scissor Sisters. What can you tell us about this song?
That song was one of the last songs that we wrote for this album, and it took us a while to get this record started. We'd been writing for a long time. We were working on a record for about 18 months that we essentially scrapped, and that was a really hard decision to make. And
now does this story in any way relate to Elton John? Because I've heard his story.
It does in a way. I mean, he's one of our best friends, and he's almost like a member of the band himself. He's very spiritually invested in what we do. And there came a point where Baby Daddy went down to Atlanta to visit and took some semblance of a record with him.
That's where it was definitely where, just that's where Sir Elton has one of his homes or a park. Right?
Yeah.
Sort of his main home.
Maybe. He called me up and said, "Do you want me to be honest with you?" And I, of course. And he just said, "This isn't it. This isn't the record."
I think we knew that. The real truth to it is that we write a lot of music, and I think there was a lot of music that wasn't pointing us in the right direction yet. We didn't go into a fancy studio somewhere and scrap $1 million worth of recording sessions. No. We write in our little studio in New York, and we have maybe too much of a classic style in terms of how we sit down and work at something instead of, oh, let's hire some great songwriters to fix this for us, or let's have the record label find us a solution. We just work at it, and it clearly wasn't working.
To go roundabout back to Fire with Fire, it was pretty much the last song we wrote for this record, and it's a song about seeing the light at the end of that tunnel and realizing that we were going to go on. I mean, I didn't know, you know, a year and a half ago if we were ever going to make another record again or if we were ever going to be on stage again. And, you know, that's really like our greatest passion is performing and making music.
Gentlemen, been a real pleasure talking to the Scissor Sisters.
Same here.
Thank you so much.
Jake Shears, Baby Daddy of Scissor Sisters. Nightwork is the Scissor Sisters' latest album. It's out now. Jake Shears and Baby Daddy joined us from the Village Studios in Los Angeles. Is there a song you want to recommend that we go out on?
I'm going to say that we're promoting. We're okay. Going to promote our new album, Nightwork, and let's play Running Out.
One, two, three, four, give me more, 'cause I think we're going down.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulipi. Thanks for listening to NPR's Arts Channel. So long.